Hello, you're very welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney, and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. This week's guest is an elder statesman of education research. He has made huge contributions to our understanding of teaching and teacher preparation. Indeed, he has also shone a light on how professionals in other fields, such as medicine, are prepared. He is Professor Emeritus at Stanford Graduate School of Education and a former president of the American Education and Research Association. I'm speaking about Professor Lee Shulman, and I am delighted that he will be the guest on the programme this week and next week. When I met up with Lee Shulman, I opened our interview by asking him how the preparation of teachers for teaching compares to the preparation of other professionals for their work.
Well, in many ways, it is conceptually quite similar, but in practice, at least in America, and here again, I've become increasingly sensitive to the fact that almost no form of higher education is global. Education at the primary, secondary, and tertiary levels varies from nation to nation, from culture to culture. And so in almost all cases, as I respond to your questions, I'll be speaking about the American experience. In the United States, as is the case with most nations that I know of, the preparation of professionals involves an attempt to find some judicious blend of preparation in what are seen as the basic foundational sciences and rarely in medicine, too rarely, arts and humanities, and supervised both training and practice in the clinical skills and the clinical strategies of professional work. If I contrast the two fields I know best, which are education and medicine, because I worked in medicine and medical education for about 10 years and did research on how people learn to do medical diagnosis, I would say the very biggest differences are these. First of all, much more time is spent both in the foundational disciplines and in learning and practicing with supervision the clinical skills of the practice. So that in the United States, for example, after 4 years of undergraduate education in medicine, where you're studying liberal arts, can include philosophy and social science as well as the biological sciences, you get a first degree, you get a bachelor's degree, and then you spend 4 full years in medical school. In the old days, it was 2 years in the basic sciences and 2 years of clinical education. And then although you get your medical degree, nobody expects you to practice. The thought that after getting your medical degree, you would turn around and begin being the sole source of treatment for patients is unimaginable, utterly unimaginable, because almost everyone at that point spends at the very least 3 full-time years of internship, sometimes in Europe called stage, and residency. And then, after that period, so now you're talking about 4 plus 4 plus 3 years of tertiary education and professional education, are you trusted to begin offering your services to the helpless clients? As we know, and I'll just use the American example, in America, you'll spend, in many places, 4 years, some of which is always devoted to general education in the arts and sciences, and at the very least 2 years of teacher training, teacher preparation, usually only 6 months, only occasionally a year, half time, of moderately supervised clinical practice. Unlike medicine, where you're on very disciplined, regulated clinical rounds day after day, in the case of internship or student teaching in primary or secondary education, you may spend a good bit of your time watching the other teacher teach. and then have short bursts of independent practice. It's dramatically different. And for me, this contrast is very, very important, because one of the things I wrote that got my colleagues in the field somewhat disturbed was when they were complaining about these alternate routes into teaching, that people were in the United States were being permitted to teach through the Teach for America program, where they had 5 weeks of training in the summer and then mentored practice to some extent during the year, or other such alternative entries into teaching. And my colleagues in teacher education, and I'm part of that community, were so critical of the irresponsibility of that. And I pointed out to them that there is so much variation among programs to prepare teachers in America that it's very hard for somebody to say, well, what exactly is professional preparation of teachers in America? Whereas in contrast, in the professional preparation of physicians, there's a great deal of similarity across programs from New York to California, from Wisconsin to Alabama, in how physicians are prepared. The biggest difference is how early these days they begin the students getting clinical practice. Because nowadays, in contrast to the old days, when you would not get any clinical experience until you had 2 excruciatingly long years of studying physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, microbiology, etc., they have now learned the virtue of doing more interweaving of the practical and the theoretical, but still highly disciplined, highly regular, highly routinized. But I don't use routine as a negative term. Routines are very important, because if our lives were not populated by routines, we'd be exhausted just driving to work in the morning, because we'd have to be problem solving all the time we're there. So I would say the biggest differences have to do with, in some ways, the seriousness with which adequate time is assigned in medicine and in education, and the regular quality of the supervision and mentoring and modeling in the clinical years, which is, I think, too often almost accidental, depending upon whose classroom you're assigned to. And so those are the big differences.
What would it take for teacher education to be more aligned or to learn from the current practice in medical education?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me preface my answer to your question by asserting, drawing upon my many years of experience in both fields, medical education and teacher education, that one of the first things you have to recognize is that the work of teachers is far more complex and difficult than the work of physicians. Compared to teaching, medicine is a piece of cake. Think of it this way. Well, I once said to a group of physicians, which did not endear me to them, that the only time the work of a physician even approached the complexity of an average day in a third grade teacher's classroom was in an emergency room during a natural catastrophe. Because by and large, when physicians do their work, they work on one patient at a time. They have access to the patient in a private space. Often they don't have to do it alone. In the case of surgery, they've got a team all around them, handing them implements and watching the blood pressure and other vital signs. But even in internal medicine, a nurse will often have done the blood pressure and the temperature and a number of things first. They've got somebody else helping take notes. And did you ever hear a physician express problems of patient management, you know, discipline problems in the examining room? And if we ever get rambunctious, we know that in that closet, next to an uninsulated wall, there are very cold stainless steel instruments that the physician can insert in various of our body orifices to calm us down. We teachers don't have that option. We're teaching 25, 30, 35 kids at a time. They all want attention at the same time. I mean, it's just so much more difficult.
But salary levels don't reflect that difference in the complexity. And not only that, but a lot of people, if you ask them, would think that anybody can teach, whereas very few would claim that anyone can be a medical doctor.
Lots of people are wrong in a lot of their perceptions. I mean, have you noticed that among the groups that regularly earn a good deal more money than physicians are professional basketball players who get far less education? Life isn't fair in that sense. Against most metrics of complexity, of social utility, of ethical responsibility, the level of salaries do not necessarily correlate very significantly. I mean, I'll bet you even earn more money than some second grade teachers. I certainly do. And you and I both know that their work is much more socially significant than anything either of us does. So I'm afraid that that's one of the ways in which the social rewards and the financial rewards of the work one does are imperfectly correlated.
But it does matter in this sense that if you know that as a medical practitioner you're going to have a good salary ahead of you, you might be prepared to spend these 11 years being apprenticed and learning your profession. Whereas if you know that you're going to be paid a relatively low salary, it's very difficult to justify extending the period of preparation for teachers.
I'm not sure what's the chicken and what's the egg. In other words, are teachers paid so poorly because people begin with the assumption that anyone can teach, therefore we don't need to take much time to prepare them, and therefore in the public view, the financial compensation and the rigor of preparation are quite appropriately matched. I mean, I don't believe that for 95%, if not higher, of a physician's practice, they actually need all that preparation. I think one of the reasons it takes so long is that even though it's highly efficient compared to student teaching, for example, over time, it's not efficient at all. It wouldn't take that long if it were. An awful lot of what the medical residents are doing is giving cheap labor to the hospitals. I think there is a mystique, a romance. Because the physicians have persuaded us that our lives are in their hands, and because the television programs and movies about physicians almost always deal with them dealing with life-threatening situations, we tend to think about medicine that way. Even though most of medical practice is dealing with ingrown toenails and with bloody noses or ear infections. I mean, if you just look at the distribution, we don't romanticize teaching. When we do, it's with movies about heroic teachers who jump on desks and motivate students from poor backgrounds to become Nobel laureates or something. But would higher salaries bring more people into teaching? Yes, no question about it. Would it also therefore mean that they would be better teachers? I have no idea.
So if you were to put more romance or mystique into teaching in order to improve it as a profession and to improve its status and its practice, what could be done?
Well, I think there are a number of possibilities, but since it's rarely been done, these ideas have never been tested as far as I know. One thing I would do is work very, very hard to make the teacher education experience far more interesting. There are many aspects of teacher education that are boring, that are not challenging. And that doesn't mean that they're routine. I don't think routine lacks interest or challenge, but some of the courses are just far too didactic. And the actual practice of teaching, I mean, I compare it to medical rounds, which is very exciting, even though it's routine. And I've often challenged my colleagues in teacher education with, what would it take to transform teacher education, at least the clinical parts of it, into something as exciting, as novel, where there's as much at stake as clinical rounds? What would it take? I'm not sure I know the answer, but I mean, that would be one example. Another example, I think, would be, I think people perceive the teaching profession as one in which individual teachers have very, very little autonomy and flexibility. I've often marveled, for example, if there's a lower paid profession with much lower job stability that is seen as more attractive very often than teaching, it's journalism. Another example is the performing arts. People go into acting and to music. Now, do you know any wealthy musicians or actors? You know of Gielgud and Olivier and Robert Redford and whomever, or Jennifer Lawrence or Meryl Streep. They represent the tiniest tip of the eye. Do you realize how many tens of thousands of people are in the performing arts, living from audition to audition, waiting tables? But it's very hard for them to give up the lure of what they're doing. How many newspaper men and women are working for small weeklies or limping by with much lower salary? What is it about those jobs that makes them so attractive? I think partly it's a sense that what I'm doing is really exciting, it's creative. And frankly, I think teaching third grade is just as exciting or creative. We haven't done a good enough job of helping people understand that. But also one of the lovely things, and journalism is a particularly good example, is journalists have a great deal of flexibility and autonomy. I mean, you talk to teachers and sometimes they'll say to you, do you realize that I'm a 10-year veteran of the profession? I don't have a telephone in my room. That's different now when you've got your own cell phone, but remember the old days. I don't have a free lunch period. I can't take a break in the middle of the day and take a nap. You know, journalists can do all of those things. There's a certain sense of self-regulation and regulation of one's life. Now, can we run public schools that way? Probably not. But could we somehow begin to try to frame the professional work so we just began to add some increments of autonomy, of flexibility to it without endangering the lives of the students? Yes, we could. So I think we've got to think in those terms.
When you started answering that question, you said that some of teacher education is boring. And yet, I mean, teacher educators see themselves as hardworking and they don't deliberately go in to bore students. Why do you think that's happening, or what could be done to make a teacher education program more exciting?
Well, now you see, I'm in danger of overgeneralizing, because in the United States, both the good news and the bad news is we have something like 1,400 teacher preparation programs. Almost every college or university in the country has some sort of teacher preparation program. The bad news is that each one thinks they can invent their own, which you would never do in the other professions. There's a set of signature pedagogies, as I call them. Another reason, though, is for a number of these institutions, teacher education is a moneymaker. It's much cheaper to educate teachers than it is to educate dentists, for example, or physicians, because you need all these teachers, you know, isn't that expensive? But for example, when I look at medicine or nursing, nursing's a very good example too. What's exciting about those fields is they start practicing from almost the first day of college or university. And they learn the sciences in the course. And I mean that as a pun as well. As part of the courses of becoming professionals. And so this integration of real practice and then reading or talking about John Dewey or Plato, you know, looking at what we've done here, let's read this description of Plato's Academy, or let's look at these dialogues of Socrates. How is the teaching that you just did similar or different from Socrates speaking in the Meno or the Euthyphro. I mean, somehow connecting to practice. I think it's going to get very interesting in the next decade or so because we're going to get much better at using simulations. One of the things that's happened in medicine is students are learning to do emergency procedures, learning to do diagnosis, learning to do surgery on robotic mannequins who are not endangered by your mistakes. But you can practice intubation of somebody who stopped breathing. You can practice cardiac stimulation with a patient whose heart is, you know. And you can even do it with buddies and practice and say, you just lost that one. You know, no. I mean, it seems jocular, but it really is. I mean, one of the things that makes so many of the other professions exciting is a lot of the signature pedagogies are done by collaborating groups where people are not in different classrooms alone, but they're both observing one another and doing things together and challenging one another and critiquing one another, scaffolding each other's learning. And doing things at that group level is always more motivating. Have you ever noticed, Sean, when you've been teaching, a kid who is too sick to go to math class turns out to be feeling well enough to go to the play rehearsal or the choir rehearsal?
Or the basketball.
Well, part of the reason is that, you know, if the sopranos don't show up, it's awfully hard to do that musical number. I feel needed. I have a role. And the same thing in a lot of these things. How many situations are there instructionally where you have this sense, if I'm not there, this lesson can't go on? I have an indispensable role to play. What would you need to do in teacher preparation to create communities of teachers who felt interdependent and were interdependent in ways that would reframe the experience of becoming a teacher in that kind of way?
You mentioned there the idea of signature pedagogies. Could you just say a little bit about what a signature pedagogy is?
It's an idea that I invented while studying education across a number of professions. This was during a period when I was president of the Carnegie Foundation. And one of the nice things about having a foundation is you've got money to do what you would like to do. And what I observed was that in the other professions, there were these very, very discernible, highly visible characteristics of professional preparation that, as I thought about my experience as a teacher educator, weren't there in teacher education. Both that, and I'll say a word about that in a moment, but also that if I walked into a law school class, I would know within a minute that this was a law school class by just what the people, how they interacted, stuff. Certainly clinical rounds in nursing or in medicine, or a studio design setting for engineering or architecture. In other words, each of these fields of professional preparation had a signature as individual and identifiable as yours and my handwriting are to a handwriting expert. I also could have called them a fingerprint pedagogy. So the signature pedagogies were, on the one hand, the regular, recognizable, predictable differences between and similarities within preparation in each of these professions. And when I began doing the work, I thought that was going to be the big idea, that each profession has its own signature, that you can begin training in Dublin and then go to London or to Mumbai, for God's sake, I think, and you'd know you were studying the same profession. There was this kind of signature for the profession, and I didn't think you'd find this in education. So that was one. It was what made these things particular and identifiably different. And then the longer I delved into this, the more I came to the conclusion, to use the language of biology and genetics, that all of these professions were phenotypically different. They looked different on the surface, but there was a genotypic underlying similarity among them that was stunning. What were some of those similarities? One was that these were pedagogies of activity. Whether you're talking about a design studio, clinical rounds, the students were not sit there listening to somebody else talking about the work. Occasionally they might, but not usually. On a daily basis, they were active doing something. There was activity. The second was they weren't acting alone. The activity was as part of a collaborating, reciprocally witnessing group, whether it was a clinical rounding group or a design group in engineering or architecture, what have you. And from the very earliest time in the program, they became attuned to the importance of not doing stuff alone, but of always doing stuff in the presence of peers, both peers at the same stage of development, but also more senior peers. In the case of medicine, when you get further up the line, more junior peers as well. You are both modeling and being modeled for. I mean, there was this kind of verticality of training. So there was visibility, there was collaborativeness. The combination of those two meant that you were always being evaluated. There were not tests at the end of something. The process of evaluation and critique was embedded in the process of doing and learning. So it was a much more natural part of what you were doing. That was part of the signature. I'm developing a design for something in my mechanical engineering course, and one of my colleagues is saying, Sean, that's not going to work because there's all this friction source here. I said, oh, yeah, but you're not doing it alone. You're working with one another on this. There turned out to be a set of underlying characteristics. And then when I map those characteristics onto most of teacher education, there you are alone with one mentor teacher in a classroom. Sometimes when you're teaching, that other teacher is watching. Sometimes they're not. The people witnessing your work are your students, but you're not asking them for feedback on your teaching. I mean, there's a whole bunch of ways in which learning to teach was not the same. And that, along with the enormous variations between institutions in how teachers were prepared, led me to write that teacher education does not exist in the same sense that medical education and engineering education do, because there's no there. And should we be surprised if public policymakers or legislators or journalists say, you people don't know what you're doing. Anybody can learn to teach because we act as if they could. That's what I had in mind.
And that claim from Professor Lee Shulman brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll bring you the second part of my interview with Lee Shulman on next week's programme. If you like what you heard in today's programme, please tell your friends about it by sharing links to the programme on social media like Twitter and Facebook. You can listen to or download podcasts of 250 previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with me by emailing feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.